and welcome to another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes. My name's Emma Burnell. I'm a political journalist, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Steve Fielding. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
And we're really delighted today to be joined by Scott Rogers, who is a professor at Birkbeck. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Emma. Hello, Steve.
And remind me, Scott, what it is that you're a professor of.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't say I'm not a professor in the UK. That's given to the people of the highest rank. So I'm a senior lecturer in media theory. And I guess one of the things that I do is I'm interested in geographies of media. So the relationship of media and cities, locality, place, and media.
And I should point out that Scott and I know each other because I studied at Birkbeck and he was my dissertation supervisor. So I will be crawling all the way through this, even out of habit, even though I've now got my grade and my master's degree.
Yes.
What was your grade, by the way? Just to remind the listener.
I got a distinction. Thank you, Steve.
Well deserved.
So this month, what we're going to cover is four films, The Hunger Games trilogy. It's a trilogy of books, and as always seems to happen now, they turn the last book into two films just to make that a little bit more money. And I was watching it a few weeks ago, just because it was on telly and we're stuck in the house all the time. And it struck me how conservative, small C rather than big C, a lot of the themes in it were, given that it's, you know, a beloved piece of art that most of my friends on the left really adore. And I thought that was really interesting, so I tweeted it, and Scott tweeted me back, and we had a really interesting discussion about whether or not it was conservative. So we thought, well, hang on, let's save the good stuff for the podcast and for you, dear listeners. So, Scott, what was your reaction to my sense that the Hunger Games is essentially a very conservative piece of work?
Well, I mean, I think the context of that discussion for me, or the way I came at it, was that I think you were saying the conservatism of the Hunger Games is one of the ways it's expressed as a kind of anti-urbanism, or that the capital represents a kind of something to oppose, and that the capital's cosmopolitan and, you know, in some ways maybe, and that there's some authenticity of the districts, and that may be a conservative narrative. And I think it's true that there is that narrative, and there's a conservative dimension to that narrative. It's a simple, effective way of presenting the story, and we see echoes of it today in the way that people talk about metropolitan London or the East Coast in the United States. One thing I guess I was trying to draw a distinction when we had the Twitter chat was that I think a difference in Pan Am is that in the film, there isn't really an anti-urbanism being promoted by the likes of President Snow, who's the president of Pan Am, the sort of totalitarian president. Like we see in the United Kingdom or the US today, where you've got these hypocritical populists extolling anti-urbanism, but they actually are based in cities. And I think the parallel only goes so far. So in The Hunger Games, capital hating is not part of the manipulative apparatus of the films. And actually, there's an argument that, you know, when people in the rebellion, which Katniss Everdeen, the kind of main protagonist in the film, is part of, when they're talking about the capital, it seems like they're actually talking about the state, really. They're not talking about the city as such. And there's examples of this. So like when they're recording propaganda films, one of the messages is, citizens of the capital, our war is not with you. Like there's this idea they're drawing a distinction between the people in the city and the government. And then there's another point in the film where they're trying to hack in to the capital's networks so they can get the propaganda films in there because they want to speak to those people, not just the people in the districts. So I guess what I was trying to say is that there's an ambiguity to the anti-urban angle. And I think that's one of the reasons why the film gets embraced by both the left and the right. So, you know, on the right, if there's a narrative there of, oh, metropolitan elites, want to force you to conform to their odd lifestyles, and you just have a simple life and you should be able to maintain that. But then on the left, people embrace it because it tells us something about, oh, totalitarian power must be resisted and we should rise up maybe against oppression. I think Donald Sutherland has even said this, that this is sort of like, that's what the message of the film is from his point of view. And so that was my kind of angle on it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a good summary of both sides of the argument. I hadn't seen it before. I mean, I'd seen the film before. I hadn't thought it through in those terms. So it was funny how much it struck me. And maybe that's because when I first saw it, we were under an Obama presidency. There didn't seem to be this, you know, quite so much of this stark divide between the rural and the rest. And It's always interesting watching a piece of art under different circumstances and how it affects you differently. I had the same thing when I watched This House. You know, I first watched it under the coalition. I second watched it under the Conservative government. And it was exactly the same play and it had a completely different message for me. So it was very interesting. Steve, what was your take?
Well, I didn't follow your exchange on Twitter. I just saw the concluding bit, but I saw all four films earlier this week, so it was relatively fresh in my mind, and I'd seen the first one a long time ago but not the other three, and so my comments are all about how it really all ends, and I think it is very, that what struck me was it is very conservative, but in a more elemental way. You know, that Katniss only gets involved to defend her sister. So the whole thing really only starts when she's defending her family. It's a very sort of conservative kind of trope. And by at the end of the film, her sister is killed, but not by the people that she's rising up against, but by the person or the people that wish to replace President Snow. And she ends up killing the woman who I see is a kind of mixture, at least in the film, of being like Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton, really, for some reason, I don't know. She actually kills her because she sees this as the president, or she temporarily puts herself in as the president. And she's just going to be exactly like President Snow. So she kills her. And Katniss only gets happiness after abstracting herself from that whole murky world of politics. And she's very uncomfortable with a lot of the kind of the resistance politics while the struggle's going on. And so at the very end of the film, you see her happy, content. And how is she happy and content? She's got a baby, she's in a nice family unit, and she's got together with Peter, the nice boy, not the kind of the more macho one, but the kind of beta male. So I thought that basic level is deeply conservative because it's raising questions about politics. Where does true happiness lie, even for this female protagonist, who you would think this is going to be a bit of a feminist film, but how does it end? With a baby and a husband.
Deeply unfeminist ending. Absolutely. No, the ending was what really kind of, having sort of seen it through this urban liberalism versus rural conservatism, that ending fits that frame so perfectly. I mean, you know, she's, as you say, her contentment is only possible as far away from not just the city, but you also get all these little, there's no technology anymore. Yeah, there's technology exists in the cities, but she has to have a gas lamp, for example. There's a really prominent shot of a gas lamp at the end. Yeah. And it's quite clearly modernity is bad, feminism is bad, go and have babies and live a simple rural life and that's the only way to be happy.
And I think also she settled for Peter. This is the other thing I thought, that because in the film there's the two different males. The one, I forget the name of the character who she truly loves, it seems to be, she truly loves him, but he's a bit of an alpha male, he's a bit problematic, you know, and he ends up possibly being even complicit in the death of her sister unknowingly, in terms of, well, it was all, you know, we didn't mean to kill her, but it was all part of that next thing we need to do to win the struggle. Whereas Peter is the more Well, like I say, a bit more like the beta male. He needs support. He's a bit broken. He's a bit this. He's a bit that. She doesn't even know she really loves him, to be perfectly honest, in the film. It's not entirely clear. But she settles for him. Maybe as a safe choice. I don't know. But it was just, I mean, I have to admit, I was irritated by the fact that there were four films, because I think there were at least, it was like 1.5 films too many. They really did stretch out that last novel into two films. So I did fast forward through the action, because it was just like, you know, what's the point of watching? Because you know who's going to die, you know who's going to live. Right, let's just get to the point. And I just was very frustrated by it at the very end, because it has been taken up, hasn't it? I mean, Wikipedia tells me, so it must be true. You know, the three-finger salute, which is in the opponent, the rebels take up, has been used in real struggles, you know, in Hong Kong, Thailand, wherever. But it's just like, this is really conservative. It's at the most elemental level.
Scott?
Yeah, I think the one of the things, I haven't read the books, but one of the things that I understand is different about the books is that it's the whole thing's told from a first-person narrative with Katniss. And I think, although I agree, and I hadn't really thought that much about that dimension of conservatism, the sort of gendered dimension of it, which is obvious, like when you, now that you've stated it, I just watched the last one and it seems, yeah, I mean, it's glaring, really. But I think in the films, there is more glimpses of the kind of social dimension of what's going on as well, which is why I think people pick up on these symbols. So it's, you know, the films could have ended with just Katniss deciding to turn her arrow on President Coin instead of President Snow. You could have just ended it at that. But then they added this almost like as a relapse to, I think, probably what the books have, which is more like this, you know, her own personal. And I think that's a tension in the films, really, because, you know, one hand you're thinking of this as it's this rebellion and there's this like this society, totalitarian society, and these things are playing out. But then you're kind of then being jolted back to sort of Katniss's individualized reasons for serving the role she serves. So anyways, I think that tension is there. And I think that conservatism is most seen when we're seeing things through Katniss's kind of perspective.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's often, you know, that's quite a common trope, isn't it? The woman in the woman to offer the non-feminist perspective, the woman to be. I'm thinking about last month's episode. You know, she's the Phyllis Schlafly of Hunger Games. I mean, I think it's, you know, thinking about Zeitgeist tapes and what we tend to talk about, I think it's a really interesting, it's such an anti-politics film. And, you know, they're nobody who achieves power does so without being corrupted in some way or another. It may be that the person who ends up in charge doesn't, but we, you know, we, as soon as she's put in place, and she's put in place rather than being someone who has fought for power, I think that's an interesting distinction. You know, we then lose her story. Her story is no longer important. It's now just about the rustic Katniss life. And I think, yeah, maybe we could play our clip now, which is, from the first film where President Snow talks about why the Hunger Games are done the way they are. And it's an incredibly cynical take on politics. So maybe we could have a listen to that now.
An 11.
She earned it.
She shot an arrow at your head.
Well, at an apple.
Near your head. Done. Why do you think we have a winner?
What do you mean?
I mean, why do we have a winner? I mean, if we just wanted to intimidate the districts, why not round up 24 of them at random and execute them all at once? It'd be a lot faster. Hope. Is the only thing stronger than fear. A little hope is effective. A lot of hope is dangerous. stock is fine, as long as it's contained.
So
contain it.
So Scott, what did you think of that?
I think one of the things that is really interesting in this film, and it's a word that comes up again and again, is hope. I think at a later point in this, I think it's in the second film, Catching Fire, Primrose Everdeen, which is Katniss's sister, says, you know, she senses something has changed. And when Katniss asks what, she says, it's hope. But early in the films, and I guess in that clip, hope seems like it's something that's kind of being manipulated. So for example, you know, where Snow is basically saying to the Game Maker, you know, a little hope is fine, but too much is dangerous because then our oppression won't work. I mean, it points out, and they're sort of saying it really explicitly, that the whole enterprise of this televised Hunger Games is to play with hope in this calculated way. So for instance, at one point in the film, Katniss and Peeta have this intimate moment, and then the production people in the control room do this, like, you know, really romantic sunset. But then shortly thereafter, they sick these vicious dog-like creatures on them. One of the things I wanted to say, though, about that is that, of course, so there is this manipulation going on, which makes us doubt hope, I guess. But I think one of the morals that they're trying to get across in the film, and we can talk about whether we agree with that or whatever, but is that the Game Maker, the president, the capital aren't in total control. So there's this like message they're trying to get across, which is hope being unpredictable. So the Hunger Games make us think about, okay, hope is something that can be manipulated, but it's never total. Political manipulation, and we think about political manipulation we have in you know, say the UK today, or in global politics as well today, it's always tapping into something deeper. And then that deeper hope can rise up and be unpredictable. I mean, I think that's at least what's being put forward as something to think about in the films.
Steve?
Well, yeah, I mean, in a sense, that's definitely right, isn't it? Because obviously the Hunger Games were meant to, and until about the 70, was it the 73rd or the 74th? Yeah, it's the 74th one, isn't it? That it actually features at the start of the film. So for 74 years, the Hunger Games has served that function, hasn't it? That hope, that little bit of hope has just been enough. And also, does it not draw some parallels between the victors and sort of celebrities? That these are people that the wider public can invest some kind of sense of hope through them and their lives as they continue after the games. So clearly, the Hunger Games and that little bit of hope has worked, hasn't it? And then the Hunger Games starts to undermine all of that. Katniss, people just invest a certain degree of hope which they're not meant to invest in. And she becomes this, I can't really understand why she becomes this symbol. So, you know, this great symbol, the Mockingjay, and everyone, you know, because they make a lot about her being this symbolic thing. And I must admit, I'm at a loss in the film as to how and why that happens, but it happens. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Hope is, in the end, that film is saying, you know, hope, manipulation, nothing's completely locked down. All regimes, however, and this may be why the left is taking it up. No regime, no matter how apparently authoritarian and totalitarian and whatever in its character, you can always overthrow it. You can. It is possible. So I guess it's the possibility that resides in uncontrollable hope.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things I wanted to pick up on there is that when you move into the later films, one of the things that becomes really clear is how the whole, not just the Hunger Games as a form of control, but then even the rebellion that follows, the war that follows, is also a media event. And there's a kind of message here about the mediatization of everything. And that, so, you know, to come back to, Steve, your point about how this Katniss becomes the Mockingjay, this kind of celebrity or symbol. I mean, in a way, what's coming across there is that Katniss isn't really a soldier or a hero in the typical sense. She's a symbol, or at least that's the way the rebellion sees her. I mean, at one point, I think in the first Mockingjay film, she's sort of passionately making these demands on President Coin about pardoning the other tributes. And Plutarch, who's a former game maker, he says right away, that's our Mockingjay. Imagine, you know, fire and gunshots in the background. So Katniss is powerful, not just because she's determined or really good in archery or something, but because she has this, she presents this image of defiance and of resistance. But I think one of the other things, there's a couple of things I would pick up on there. There's a kind of point they're making too about authenticity or the importance of authenticity, maybe for younger people. I don't know. There's a kind of generational thing we can talk about later maybe, but you know, when the rebellion tries to then produce these, what they call propos, these propaganda films on this sort of green screen background, it doesn't really work. It lacks the authenticity. Katniss can't do it basically. So they send her off to District 8 Field Hospital, which then gets attacked. And then she films this really authentic kind of reaction to it. And they sort of latch onto that. And even throughout the actual rebellion, the actual attack on the Capitol, they're trying to create this sort of authentic media narrative. And I think one of the things that comes out of that to me is that the Capitol and the rebellion actually use similar grammars of media technique. Like they're not actually that different. It's not like the rebellion has this really democratic kind of, they're actually doing propaganda films as well. They're almost like American political ads or something like that, some of them. So, you know, when in the final film, when Katniss is in the Capitol, which is under siege at the time by the rebellion, she's basically in this like symbolic military unit, really. They're like advancing behind the front line. And yeah, sure, they still are encountering all these sophisticated traps and life-threatening dangers. But their job is basically to create this propo footage that's supposed to win over minds, not to actually defeat them militarily. And there's this really good quote, I think, from Finnick, who's one of the other past tributes or past contestants in the Hunger Games. He immediately grasps when they're describing how they're going to proceed through the city. He goes, well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 7600 Hunger Games. And it's obviously cinematically also a way for the director and the people who created this film to do another Hunger Games without it actually staging another Hunger Games. But it's also interesting, I think, because it kind of underscores that it's not just a view of mediatized politics. Like I think it presents us with a kind of way in which politics is mediatized and makes us think about the world we live in today.
Yeah, I think the authenticity point is really interesting. So sorry, Steve, I bring you in a second, but I just wanted to add, because Katniss learns to play the game. And that is partly how she wins. She has this natural instinct for being a media star, even if she doesn't like doing it. So I think that the moment that she becomes the hero rather than just the protagonist is when she looks after Rue. And that's where the whole Mockingjay and the cymbal and the tune is, because she sings to Rue. And that, you know, she's showing her human side, her empathetic side, the side that initially she really resisted playing up to because she just felt it was all inauthentic. So I thought that was, you know, that struggle of authenticity happens both within the films, but also within Katniss herself. Sorry, Steve, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, no, it's just that, yes, I think Katniss, she's uncomfortable when she's put into that position of having to play up. I mean, that's clear, but that's part of the strength that we're meant to admire her for being uncomfortable, aren't we? So she's kind of authentic. I mean, again, maybe this points to the more basic conservative of the film, given she's the lead female character, that her strength is her authenticity, not artifice, right? Mm-hmm. And women are meant to be closer to nature, and I don't know if, you know, go down that route a little bit, maybe. So she's authenticity, but sometimes put into a position of having to be inauthentic, but she doesn't like doing it. So in order to actually express the things that the rebels wanted to say, she has to go into the real situation, really express what she thinks. She can't do it in a studio. And yeah, the point about the rebels, or at least the leadership rebels, and President Snow's regime, the Capitol's regime, is that they're both inauthentic. I think that, I mean, that I hadn't really seen it quite like that until Scott had said it. I mean, they literally get the game maker, who turns out to be a rebel, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character. He does the job, albeit undercover, for the last, you know, for the last Hunger Games. And then he switches sides and he's doing exactly the same job of manipulating, of doing all those props and things that you were talking about, Scott. So in a way, it's sort of reinforcing that fundamental conservatism that the rebels and the capital are ultimately doing the same kind of thing. And there's only Katniss who stands outside as the authentic other. And then she can only survive by becoming completely authentic and going back to the country and having a baby and, you know, being an Earth mother or whatever she's meant to be at the very, very end. But I wondered about, because I, to some extent, it's being unfair a little bit on politics because of its position. Because President Coyne, I don't understand where she where she starts from and how she ends up being what she is. Because she starts off being, and this is why I thought she was a bit like Hillary Clinton, being a kind of automaton. She was really boring. You know, she was like just standing there and, she, you know, she seemed to be, you know, the heart was in the right place, but she couldn't sell herself. You know, she they actually make a point about her killing the room or something. And then she suddenly seems to learn how to put on emotion in the public and to put things on. And I don't know what, and then she ends up being almost, well, she wants to be President Snow, but the rebels President Snow. Let's have a Hunger Games is what she says towards the end of the film. And it looks like she's going to be, you know, whatever regime follows is going to be exactly like the previous regime, which is why Katniss has to kill her. But we don't really know where, you know, she's like a cardboard character. It's not, you know, why does she end up like that? But anyway, that's what I thought.
Going back to the clip again, if you think about when the first film came out, all that stuff about hope, you know, hope was very much associated with a particular president, President Obama. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this cynical read of hope is a manipulation, a film coming out and saying that in the electoral year of Obama's re-election, is actually making quite a statement, isn't it?
Yes, implicitly. I mean, quite. I don't know if anyone ever picked up on that, but because if ever I associate one politician with the word hope, it obviously is Obama and all those posters. So you'd have thought that could be. Although I've not read the novels, so the novels obviously precede the film, so it just could be,
I think the dominant way hope comes up in the film is in the positive way, really. I mean, the manipulation is, you know, maybe our read into it. The manipulation of hope itself is not as obvious, I don't think, in the film. I mean, it is. It is.
We're the cynics.
Yeah. Well, yes, we are. We're all analysts, and we're looking at this too hard. But I think that you know, that the clip and those other parts of the film where, you know, Snow and the Game Maker are talking about it very openly and explicitly, and really they're trying to tell, you know, it's trying to tell the audience, you know, this is manipulation. But I think when hope is actually, the word is actually used, it tends to be more positive, that it's like the unpredictable hope that, you know, can overcome and against all odds, etc. One thing I just want to say is, in addition to the gendered read, one of the things I've seen out there in terms of what Katniss represents is more generational. I think I mentioned it earlier. You may have heard of this, but that there's an economist, Narina Hertz, has got a bit of notoriety for saying that, you know, we should, for Generation Z, the generation that comes after the millennials, we shouldn't call them that. We should call them Generation K, as in Generation Katniss. And what Hertz is trying to say is that, you know, Generation K, as she calls it, or Generation Z, see their world as like dystopian, unequal, harsh. They feel disconnected from the public world that they are encountering. And Katniss represents that, or some people would say that she represents that, rather than this sort of conservative kind of femininity and you know, what we discussed earlier about how the film ends, but also that, you know, this Generation K sees themselves as living in a world where there's these existential threats that they could actually, you know, that within their lifetime even there could be a threat to their livelihood, and that they want authenticity in politics. Katniss rejecting these contrived propose, or they're fundamentally lonely. I think that's one of the things that Hertz is really interested in, that they seek connection. And, you know, you see when Katniss is in the Hunger Games, she kind of goes against the competitive nature of it and makes it all about collaboration, that and only reluctantly kills when it's like absolutely necessary. So anyways, I just wanted to throw that in there. I think that generational dimension I think there is something in that, and it's another kind of political theme in the films.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because there isn't so much a generational element in the content of the films, but very much in the audience. Yeah, these came from young adult fiction, didn't they? And the books were originally aimed at that young adult audience. And you know, God, if I was 14 right now, I'm not sure I'd feel much hope. It's absolutely everything coming at that generation, isn't there? It's bad enough being 45, I tell you. But in the films, I mean, obviously you've got young Katniss, who rarely wears makeup, which is a very interesting choice. When she does, it's full of artifice, versus old Snow. And he's even called Snow, for goodness sake, with his shock of white hair. That's a bit on the nose, isn't it? But actually, the rebels are various ages. There isn't kind of a young rising up against the old, the youth taking on the system. Even the when they have the Quarter Quell, there's a huge variation of ages in the champions, because they were, some of them will have been have won the games 25 years previously. Steve?
Although the basic function of the Hunger Games was for the various districts to sacrifice their young to maintain the status quo, which seems to benefit quite a lot of old people, but particularly President Snow and those in the capital. So I think, that's absolutely right what Scott's saying. I didn't know about the Marina Hertz kind of sort of attempt to draw it all out like that. But there's clearly a generational perspective to that. And I can't say how a young person would read that because I'm not a young person. I'm shuffling off this model call at some point soon. So, but I would imagine that there'd be a heck of a lot of identification with her from people of that generation, particularly at this time. Because I mean, I know the whole idea of the youth quake in Corbyn was completely, wasn't statistically ever verified, but there was a sense amongst certain people that this was going on, that young people feeling detached from and antagonistic, and you can just see how many old people are really well off and condemning young people to all kinds of stuff that's unfortunate for them. And so I would be surprised if people of a certain age weren't drawing those very strong parallels. But I think the film finessed it a little bit, didn't it? You're right. It's in the end, it wasn't really the generational narrative got a bit monkeyed up a bit. But even so, if that is a true reflection of how many young people think, it's still a conservative way of thinking. They just want to get on, be left alone, stop. We just want to have our own little lives. Ultimately, it's not an Owen Jones version of youth quake, is it? It's somewhere towards a more private-centered youth quake that we have to rebel in order to be normal, just to what we think normal life might be.
That's borne out in a lot of polling, that while young people are angry about the chances they aren't having, what they're angry about is their inability to own property, their inability to have jobs that and careers, and exactly that kind of normal. It may be considered conservative to be a climate change denier and progressive to be a climate change campaigner, but actually what they're trying to do is conserve the planet. There are definitely readings that says being ecological it shouldn't be a left-right issue. Steve?
Can we talk about, I don't know if we're running out of time, but can we talk about, at least briefly, what the film says about the functionality of the Hunger Games in terms of the politics of the whole regime? Because obviously a lot of people sort of saw the Hunger Games as a kind of comment on the reality TV shows and all that kind of stuff. And it gives the impression, if the Hunger Games are a kind of dystopian version of Big Brother, that those celebrity reality shows are functional to the maintenance of the status quo. And it's, And the film has a kind of quite very crude Marxist idea of the functionality of the Hunger Games. And before we kind of go into it, I just want to say Stanley Tucci's teeth, they should have their own kind of credit, really, because the way how they parody that kind of reality TV show compare host, and Stanley Tucci is Caesar, who's the kind of the main host, and he does it. He his rendition of all those awful presenters who camp it up, you know, in order to get the audience going, I think is that's an Oscar-worthy performance, frankly. But anyway, that's a slightly silly point. But I just wondered what you thought about how convincing that was if we were going to read The Hunger Games as an understanding of how those kinds of things function today in real time.
One of the things that I think that was kind of it pops up in the first film. But it's I don't know if it's really actually explained that well. It's just why do people keep in the districts who seem to be so oppressed still buy into this whole thing every year? And is it just that they're forced to be interested in it? There's this one scene where Gale is talking with Katniss, and he says something like, you know, just one year, what if everyone stopped watching? You know, you root for your favorites, you cry when they die, it's sick. And he said, well, if no one watches it, they don't have a game, and it's as simple as that. Like, he's suggesting that you could kind of like abstain from it, which reminds me of the way that people talk about Facebook, for example, right now. So, but when he says that, Katniss is kind of bemused. Like, she almost is laughing. Like, you know, she knows that the games aren't just enforced, that actually, I mean, this is my read on it anyways, that emotionally people are so invested in it that it's not, people are not just going to opt out and pull out. And it made me think, I mean, and obviously I think we already mentioned this, that of course this has been happening for 70 years. So, I mean, I think, you know, we can presume that that's true, that it's so much part of the world of Pan Am that it's hard for people to even imagine this annual event not happening and not being part of the whole fabric of like meaning in their society. But I guess, so one of the things that it also made me think about though was just a lot of debates now about the difficulty of disconnecting from platforms we have, which is our even less than, you know, reality TV maybe is fading. I mean, obviously reality TV is still very present, but especially platforms now are one of the things that we're really invested in a different way than maybe reality TV. There's a really good book by Tiro Karpi called Disconnect. It's about Facebook and the difficulty of disconnecting and how Facebook is really invested in and deterring us from disconnecting. But the way it does it is not by, you know, kind of technically making it hard, but it's really by encouraging us to form these really emotional affective bonds through the platform so that it's actually really hard to disconnect from it. That, you know, if you do, you will potentially lose a lot of connections to friends, social connections. Some people might even lose work connections. They might put their career at risk and that sort of thing. And that's why there's a lot of media narratives now about that. All these people talking about leaving Facebook, it's a privilege to leave Facebook. You're privileged if you can leave Facebook, actually, because there's some people who just can't afford to leave Facebook. I'm not really saying Facebook is like the Hunger Games, but I think there's something about, and this is a different than a Marxian reading maybe, it's almost more of a kind of sociological practical reading of thinking about how we get interdependent in our everyday life with media content like shows, reality TV. Also, you could look at the way that people have read tabloids in the past and how that becomes part of the fabric of their life, and they just internalize certain things, like The Sun has been publishing for years, and they've been reading it for sports maybe more than anything else. But I think this is something that I don't think is actually explained that well in the film. Like, it's kind of like, how is the Hunger Games part of people's everyday life? It doesn't. Maybe it's a totalitarian society, and it's not easy to compare to one like Britain or the US today or Canada or wherever.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. God, I should have known, having two academics on, I'd get a sociological reading and a Marxian reading of the Hunger Games. I think we need to wrap up. So has anyone got any sort of fine? I mean, it's worth saying, I think Steve's right that there is about half a film too much of the whole product, but it is really enjoyable. I think particularly Caesar is a great character. And I say this as someone, you can tell that I'm lisping slightly because I'm currently wearing tooth aligners so I can get his smile. But I think it's an enjoyable film. It just, when I revisited it all, it just shocked me how much I was reading it completely differently than I had when I'd originally watched it. So it was definitely worth discussing, I thought. Any final thoughts, Scott, as our guest?
No, I think we've really covered it well. There's lots of, I mean, there's a whole like literature on this out there. So I'm sure if people want to analyze it more than we have already, they could go and take a look around.
Brilliant. Steve?
No, I've got nothing to add. I just want to know if there's free car parking. That's all.
Okay. on our Zoom call.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it just leaves me to say thank you very much to Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production. Oh, and please rate and review us on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts.